Right. Hi, everyone. I'm Nick Zubanov, your lecturer in the course Compensation and Benefits. I am sorry for the delay today, and I am sorry that the lecture last week was cancelled. It happened at a rather short notice. I had a huge clash in my schedule. There was no other way to accommodate this. But I've reorganized lecture slides in such a way as to make up for the materials of as to make up for the loss of one lecture in this course. So we're okay. Now, Compensation and Benefits is a master level course. Is everybody a master student here? All right. So today we're going to do an introduction. We're going to look at, you know, it's a gentle introduction to compensation and benefits. I will tell you a couple of stories. Hopefully they'll be half interesting to at least some of you. And I hope that next time I will see some of the students coming back to my lecture. Now, we will be doing lectures such as today and tutorials. Now, I will be doing both lectures and tutorials, and the course organization is very simple. There is a lecture every week with one exception, and there is a tutorial every other week. Okay, so that makes it approximately 3 academic hours per week. Now, the lecture slides have been uploaded to the course's ILIAS page, which has been made active this morning. So if you go to ILIAS, you will see all lecture slides in one place. What you will also see is past exam. And as we progress, I will be uploading supplementary materials such as academic articles to which I will be referring during the course, and slides for tutorials. So the set of items that you see on the ILIAS webpage is not the final, is not the whole amount of materials that you need to familiarize yourself with to do well in the course. So most of it is there, but tutorial slides I'll be uploading later on. Now, so there is a textbook for this course, and you can see it on this slide. This slide is also uploaded to ILIAS, so you don't need to write anything down unless you want to make a note to clarify things. This is the background textbook. So what it means is that the lecture slides have a sort of script for the course that you need to learn. Well, not by heart, but you know what I mean, yeah? So you're not obliged to buy this textbook, okay? Even though it's a good idea. It's a background textbook in the sense that this provides the basis for one of the basis for the lectures. The other basis for the lectures are academic articles and a selection of other textbooks from which I derive content. So if you want to sort of to familiarize yourself more with the background behind the lectures, if you want to learn a few things in detail related to this course, then you may consider buying this textbook. It's a very famous textbook. Look, it's gone through 11 editions. It means that it's hugely popular in the literature. Now, what are the tutorials? So lectures are lectures. Everybody knows what lectures are. During tutorials, we will be doing two things. One thing we'll be doing are simple exercises on the theoretical models presented during the lectures, so that you would see the theory and how it works in some stylized cases. And the other part of tutorial activities will be going through academic articles published in scientific journals. This is a master level course, as one of the learning outcomes in the master program is to familiarize students with not only textbook materials but also results of research. So these research results are communicated most of the times in the form of academic articles, and some of the articles relevant to this course will be going through during the tutorials. So, now, there is no midterm, there is no homework, there is no course paper, nothing. 100% of the final exam is determined, 100% of the grade is determined by final exam. The final exam is a 90-minute test with questions based on the material of the course. You could have a look at one of the last year's exams on the ILIAS webpage to have an idea about the sort of questions that you may expect. Of course, the 2017 exam will not be the same as 2015 exam, but you know, to get a general idea, I think it's helpful. Now, so I like to talk to students, you know. I like my lectures to be participatory. What it means is I like to receive questions and comments from students. So your participation during lectures and tutorials, your questions, your clarification questions, your challenges, your comments, your opinions, the expression of your opinions in a civilized way is encouraged. But it's not going to be graded, okay? So you're not going to get extra points for, you know, asking questions and course participation, for a very simple reason, that I may be an okay academic, but I'm totally useless when it comes to administration, record keeping, organizing things, etc. So even if I did want to encourage student participation by giving them incentives in the form of extra points for this course, later on, when it comes to working out the final grade, I will have forgotten and students will keep reminding me, and then it all becomes a big mess. So, sorry, no encouragement for student participation other than the intrinsic motivation to do so and the interest in this course and the willingness to learn more. Because how do you learn? You learn from reading and listening, that's for sure, but you learn a lot from asking questions. So if you want to learn a lot, ask questions. If you don't ask questions, you don't learn as much. So I don't know how much you know about myself and how much it's important to know about myself, but very briefly, I'm a professor of organizational economics at University of Konstanz. I joined this university in October 2016. So I taught one semester at this uni teaching Unternehmensorganisation to first-year bachelor students and personnel economics course to third-year bachelor students and quantitative methods in management research to master students. So I taught two bachelor courses and one master course. The master course was a great success. I really like teaching to master students. I think master students are more mature. Bachelor courses were a disaster. I don't know how much you've heard about it. Am I a good teacher? I like to think I'm a good teacher, actually, but despite the student evaluations, and what I think makes a good teacher is, not only the knowledge of the material, but also the sort of relevant and provocative and intellectually stimulated manner in which courses are given. So bachelor students, as I learned from really angry comments in student evaluations, the bachelor students really hated when I ask questions and encourage discussion and participation. They basically come to lectures, they want to listen, they want to take their notes, and they want to walk away undisturbed. And if they feel like sleeping, they don't want their sleep to be disturbed. Master students are a little bit more dynamic. So that's why my evaluations for master courses are typically way higher than for bachelor courses. But here I am, and you're master students. It's very important for me, right? So I also learned that it's sort of not within the culture of South Germany to, you know, for a lecturer to ask questions, to sort of cherry pick students and ask them questions. When I worked at Goethe University in Frankfurt, it's Hessen, it's in middle Germany, was quite okay, and students actually, you know, not that they actually liked it, but they didn't dislike it. So here I'll try to deny myself the pleasure of picking individual students and grilling them during lectures, because, you know, I don't want to make people I don't want to make people angry, but you know, a little bit of intellectual challenge, a little bit of spice, a little bit of provocation during the lecture is actually great, because this is how you're going to learn things. So if you expect you come here, read through boring notes, some theories, alpha and beta, some boxes and arrows, what fun is it? Not fun for me. I would rather do my research, because I'm also an active researcher. I'm supposed to do teaching and research, but what I do most times is research. And you can read about my research on my webpage, which I think is quite exciting. And if you are thinking about writing a master thesis, or if you just want to talk to me about research, my door is always open. I have formal office hours on Thursday, but you can just knock on my door, and if I have time, we'll talk. So I encourage students to establish contacts with their fellow students, of course. You know, you have to grow and nurture your network. It will help you. But I also encourage students to establish network and contacts with professors for a very simple reason. First, two reasons. First, you learn more this way because you ask questions. Second reason, you will have someone to write your recommendation letter, to write your reference letter. When you're applying, it really is important, because I receive dozens, well, not hundreds, but dozens of emails from my favorite bachelor students, asking me to write a recommendation letter for them to apply to master program, or you know, further studies or work, because you know, everybody needs a Zeugnis, right? And these emails go straight into the trash bin, because I don't know these people, right? How am I going to write a Zeugnis to someone who I don't even know the face of, right? Or name? I haven't spoken to them. So if you want to get good recommendations, you have to be good students, and you have to know the people who you're going to ask for recommendations. So do talk not only to each other, but also to the professors at this uni. Not only to myself, but I think it's a generally valid point. Now, the last thing I have to say about sort of myself and teaching and research is that my favorite topic of research is incentives. So I'm going to be talking a lot about incentives in this course, as well as in other courses. Incentives, Anreize? Yeah, know this? Okay, so the big word, the big term for this course will be incentives. Now, let's talk about the course schedule. So the lectures are on Tuesdays at 11:45 to 13:15 in this room. There is a regular lecture on Tuesday each week, except 6th of June 2017. On the 6th of June 2017, there is no lecture and no tutorial. I'm going to an econometric society conference in Hong Kong. It's a big conference, and it's an invited session, so I couldn't really turn down the invitation. That's why I'm going. So 6th of June, no lecture, no tutorial. Now, so today we're going to do introductory lecture, tell a few interesting stories about compensation and benefits. Next week, we're going to put compensation and benefits in the context of strategic human resource management, right? So because compensation benefits is part of human resource management, and what makes it strategic is the long-term effects of compensation and benefits practices on employee performance, and through employee performance on firm performance. That's what we're going to learn today and next week. Now, the lectures on the 16th and 23rd of May 2017, these are the, I don't want to call them the most important lectures of the course, but these are the two lectures that everybody has to come. Okay, because these are the lectures where we'll be going through the theoretical foundations of compensation benefits. We'll be going through a suite of models, a suite of theoretical models from economics that establish at the theory level the relationship between compensation and motivation. between between how much money people get and the effort that they're choosing to exert. So we'll be going through the notions of compensating wage differentials. We're going to go through the models of signaling and screening and efficiency wages. Okay, so I don't know if you know about these terms, efficiency wages. Yeah, some people have heard about them. Well, everybody's heard about signaling, right? Yeah, so signaling, we're going to do signaling in a simple way. So not the big model of Michael Spence at Quarterly Journal of Economics. Now, on the 23rd of May, there will be a tutorial in room D431 at 3:15. There will be a tutorial on efficiency wages, signaling, and screening. So we will solve a couple of questions. We will put the models of signaling, screening, and efficiency wages to some use by populating them with numbers and see how far we can get. Okay, now, the most important lecture of the course is on the 30th of May. Do make sure you're there. On the 30th of May, there's a lecture as part of the theoretical foundations of CNB. We'll be looking at incentives. And we'll be looking at incentive pay contracts. So, of course, the linear incentive scheme, but not only linear incentive scheme, also the bonus incentive scheme, will be presented in a theoretical way on the 30th of May. Now, so then 6th of June is out. The next Tuesday is 13th of June. And on the 13th of June, we will be moving from theory to empirics. Right, so far we've been doing theory, theoretical models, signaling, screening, incentive contracts. On the 13th of June, we'll be going through empirical evidence on the efficiency of CNB practices. So models are good. Models establish theoretical predictions. Whether these predictions hold in the real world is an open question. There is a big literature testing theoretical predictions of compensation and benefits models, and we will be going through selected studies from this literature on the 13th of June. On the same day, there will be a tutorial on incentive pay contracts, the same idea. We'll take a few theoretical models of incentive pay contracts and do some algebra with them. Okay. So, 20th of June... this is a proper HRM lecture now. We'll be looking at practical considerations, at basically the design issues related to incentive pay, or how it's called in HR practice, pay for performance plans. So they don't like the word scheme, because scheme suggests, you know, some Bernie Madoff stories, but they like plans. Okay, so we'll be looking at the design of incentive plans on the 20th of June. And 27th of June, we're going to be looking at how the pay for performance plans designed by individual firms fit and relate to the rest of the market, how competitive the pay packages are. The total pay package, not only the incentive part of it. And how to make the pay package competitive? And should you make the pay package competitive? Could it be a valid strategic option to pay peanuts and get monkey, as the old proverb goes? Or do you always have to pay lots of money to get geniuses? Not always. It's strategic choice, as many choices that people make in compensation benefits. Now, 27th of June 2017, a very interesting tutorial. I'm looking forward to presenting it to you. This tutorial is not going to be about algebra, okay? This tutorial is going to be about going through a very famous paper published in Journal of Finance, a number one journal in finance, for those who are interested in this field. This is a paper about the effect of compensation practices on risk-taking by individuals. So Very, very interesting tutorial. Not only compensation benefits practices affect effort by providing motivation, typically extrinsic, but also intrinsic at times, but also they have some secondary order effects on work attitudes such as risk taking, and we'll be looking at what is going on there during that tutorial. 4th of July, designing benefits, the lecture on the designing benefits schemes. So these two lectures, pay for performance plans and competitive pay package, are about largely about incentive pay. Now, but remember, the name of the course is compensation and benefits, right? So far we have forgotten the word benefits. Well, we haven't really forgotten the word benefits. Here's a lecture on benefits. Here we'll be learning about the different types of benefits. There are hundreds and hundreds of different types of benefits, so you're not going to learn all of them. You don't have to learn all of them. What you do have to learn is why benefits are paid at all. What are the reasons behind benefits, right? Why can't you just monetize everything in your wage and give people a monetary equivalent of the total compensation package? There are a couple of reasons behind the decision to structure compensation and benefits package in the form of compensation and benefits. Now, 11th of July, a lecture on performance evaluation. This period in the semester typically coincides somewhere near the evaluation or somewhere after the evaluation period, so you will be evaluating me. Then there will be a lecture on evaluation, and then there will be an exam, and I will be evaluating you. So everybody is evaluating everybody. Why is evaluation a part of the compensation and benefits course? The reason is this. Whenever you design an incentive pay package, an incentive pay plan or scheme, whatever, this scheme is based on a measure of performance, right? A certain measure of performance. You get paid for doing something, and the something that you do is measured. Now, almost always, in the majority of cases, your measurements of performance are not perfect. Now, the imperfectness of measuring performance has interesting implications for the design of incentive pay schemes. So during this lecture, we'll be looking at how performance is measured, what are the advantages and disadvantages of different ways of measuring performance, and how it all leads to being an input into the design of incentive pay schemes. 18th of July, there is a lecture on discrimination, another important topic or on the interface between HRM and compensation and benefits. 25th of July is the last lecture of the course, and this will be the revision lecture. Revision lecture is a very important part of my courses because, well, and not only my courses, my practice is this. I encourage people to go through the lecture slides and other course materials and make up a list of questions that they would like to be reviewed by me. And send these questions by email sometime between these two lectures, preferably right after the discrimination lecture, so that I would have more time to go through your questions. And then during the revision lecture, I will be answering the questions from students. So the agenda for this lecture is not specified. It will be based entirely on the questions that I will receive from students. And later on that day, we will have a tutorial. Now, the topic of tutorial is still work in progress. I'm not sure whether we will do a tutorial on discrimination or whether we will go through the last exam. I will ask for your feedback, what you think, whether you want to do a tutorial on discrimination or you want to do a tutorial on going through the last exam. The majority vote will determine the topic. So, compensation matters. Compensation matters because... Well, why does it matter? Well, money is one of the things that move people, right? So why do you do things? What are you doing at this university? Why are you studying? Why do you have to wake up early and go to bed late? Why do you have to learn these courses? Well, everybody say, okay, for intellectual enrichment. Yeah. To find a good job and make good money and buy a nice car and nice house, etc. So compensation motivates people to do things. All right? But why would firms want you? Why would firms offer you more money for more years of education? You know, what's the interest of the firms? Well, that's an interesting story, and I'm not going to tell it in full because it's a long story. So the first approximation is that firms offer higher compensation and benefits packages, higher rewards for more years of education because it is believed that more education makes people more productive. And it does make people more productive. There's a huge literature on returns to education, both in terms of productivity as well as in terms of social behaviors. So if you want people to be more productive, if you want people to work harder, you have to offer them money. And money is actually the most powerful motivator for people to work. I'm not saying that money is the only motivator for people to work. There is intrinsic motivation. People can do work for the sake of work itself, you know, if they have a feeling of mission or a noble cause. But by and large, what moves us is by and large money. Okay. So now compensation matters to encourage to employees to work hard, to motivate them to do things that are good for the organization. Now, the second reason why compensation matters is compensation affects firm performance beyond the effect it has on employee motivation. And the reason here is very simple. You don't need to study compensation and benefits to know this. The reason is that, well, a large share of operational costs of any business concern are labor costs. So how you manage the labor costs budget, how you distribute the total of the expenses that you have to spend on labor costs will determine not only how motivated your employees are and how much effort they will put in your work, but it will also determine the bottom line by affecting the entire labor costs budget. Now, compensation and benefits, the course compensation and benefits is important not only for you and for me, they're also important for society at large. Okay, so what are the implications? What are the implications of compensation and benefits for the society at large? Several implications, I guess, but one most popularly cited is the public interest in earnings. Right? In Germany, it's not acceptable to ask how much money you make. Right? It's one of those questions. It's much more acceptable to ask how much rent you pay, which is a sort of noisy proxy for how much money you make. And if you really want to learn about how much money you make, you ask how much rent you pay. So it's much more acceptable, right? Do you see what I mean? Yeah? So of course, everybody is interested in how much money everybody's earning, right? I'm hugely interested in how much money people are earning. Yeah, I can't satisfy this interest because it's not acceptable, but I'm very, very interested. Yeah, so let's not pretend I'm not. Now, in some cases, this information is actually public. In Canada, for instance, any civil servant that earns more than $100,000 Canadian has his or her salary published on the website. So I have a couple of friends who now work in Canada in academia, and I know exactly how much they're earning and in what year. Really? So maybe when we have a tutorial, I'll show you this website. It's great fun. You can look up people. So there is a considerable public interest in how much people earn. Where does this interest come from? Not only idle curiosity, right? So of course we're all curious, and but it's not only curiosity. It's also a thing known as fairness considerations. Have you heard of the term fairness? Yeah. So there's an economic theory of fairness. Peer-related fairness. There's distributional fairness. People have fairness concerns, and to satisfy these fairness concerns, they need information about their relative position in the pay distribution in the society, to know which they, of course, would like to know how much money other people make. And the case in point here is the top earners' pay. You know, I'm not really hugely interested in how much money, you know, low-paid workers earn, right? Because well, first of all, there isn't a lot of variation there. And you could pretty much see how much they earn by reading job adverts, right, which report hourly pay, etc. But when it comes to executive pay, for instance, right, the public interest in executive pay is huge, and for good reason. You know, those of you who still remember the years of financial crisis of 2008 onwards, right, you may recall. You may recall the Troubled Assets Relief Program, the TARP, in the United States. Remember this, the TARP? So what they did is they distributed billions of taxpayers' money in the United States to temporarily lend this money to troubled banks, right? By purchasing troubled assets, hence the term. And what some of these banks and insurance companies did, they were too big to fail. So to keep the financial system going, you have to keep them liquid. So there was a rationale behind this program. But what happened is some of the banks and insurance companies paid huge benefits to their executives. And where does the money come from which they paid these benefits? They paid from taxpayers' money. And of course, it caused a furore. It caused a rage in newspapers, protests, etc. We are the 99% slogan, etc. So public is interested in compensation benefits when it comes to high earners' pay. Now, firms cannot stay ignorant to this interest because the way firms craft their compensation and benefits policies may have reputational concerns for these firms, right? So to satisfy some of these concerns, there's a cheap way. You know, a few executives, most notably the late Steve Jobs, a few executives receive a nominal salary of $1 per year. Right, so you say, look, guys, I'm not earning anything from this company. I of course I have some shares, but shares are much less controversial for some reason than remuneration, even though they come from the same sources. So firms cannot stay ignorant to the public interest in the compensation and benefits practices that they devise, and it might be a way to improve or ruin one's reputation. By designing compensation and benefits policies which affect firms' reputation in a positive or negative way. Now, let me tell you a few stories about how compensation and benefits practices can really make a difference to firm performance to stimulate your further interest in this course. So here's an old case study, which comes from the paper by Raff and Summers in the Journal of Labor Economics. This is an old paper, but it's still generating a lot of interest because it's one of a few pieces of empirical evidence for efficiency wages. And that's one of the terms, one of the concepts that we're going to go through in this course. So here's Ford Motor Company, early 20th century. People were paid, workers were paid by the day, workers on the assembly line were paid by the day, a few dollars a day, and Ford introduced a pay rate of $5 a day. And, you know, people said, you've got to be crazy, you're wasting money. And he said, no, I'm not wasting any money, and I'm not being a kind charitable person. There's a pure business considerations here. Car industry. It's a high precision manufacturing industry. Everything has to work. Everything has to fit together. If you don't have a conveyor, if you don't have robots assembling cars, as is the case now, if cars are assembled by people who can make mistakes and who you need to have experienced, well-working, well-coordinated teams of workers to assemble good cars on this on those primitive conveyor belts. But look what happened. In 1913, the turnover, employee turnover, was 370% per year. It means that an average worker worked between 2 and 3 months in one workplace, then he would move. What can you learn in 2 or 3 months? How can you become productive, experienced, well-coordinated, well-connected team member if your expected job duration is somewhere between 2 and 3 months? There's no way. You're going to make lots of mistakes. You're going to be absent a lot of times. You're not going to be very productive, right? If in the environment in which turnover is so huge. But then what makes you change jobs so often? Because basically you're poor. And you are after every extra penny that you can earn from somewhere. So if you hear that somebody is offering, 1 cent more, you'll move there. Then next day you hear that somebody is offering another cent more, you'll move there as well. So if you want to have a smoothly operating, profit-making, productive, reliable business, you have to deal with a huge level of employee turnover that your business is facing. How do you deal with this level of employee turnover? You prevent people, well, you can't prevent people from moving, they are not slaves, but you can motivate them not to move. How? By offering them lots of money, right? So when people from University of Constance, when professors at University of Constance come to the job market and apply to other universities, then there is a policy at Constance to invite these professors who received offers from other institutions to invite them to a negotiations meeting, during which meeting the rector will make a counteroffer or not make a counteroffer. So you offer a bit more money to prevent people from moving and to sort of lock them in at your organization. That's exactly what Henry Ford did, maybe not in such a small proportion, maybe not so delicately, just jacked up the pay rate by more than 2 times a day, $5 a day. And this was a drastic improvement in the performance, in the economic performance of Ford factories. Turnover going down, absenteeism going down, productivity increased by 70%. The bottom line effect was actually positive. The payment of $5 a day was one of the finest cost-cutting moves we ever made. Cost-cutting, right? So compensation and benefits clearly matter for firm performance. One thing you can do is offer people lots of money so that they will stay, they will have no incentive to move, and by staying longer they will become more productive and better coordinated with the rest of the work team. So here's another case when compensation and that illustrates the importance of compensation and benefits for firm performance. This time it was a disaster. Welcome to General Motors. Now a fully reformed automotive company, but for the period of time that this case study looks at, it's published in Forbes magazine. So it was in deep mess, largely self-made mess. What happened? Well, these guys had a very powerful trade union, and this trade union didn't understand simple economics. This trade union very lax and inefficient management, they negotiated a very generous pension deals and unemployment deals between the company, the General Motors, and its workers, right? So what's wrong with generous compensation and benefits deals. Nothing's wrong with compensation, with generous compensation and benefits deals, except that they really rack your bottom line. Everything has to be in proportion. You offer incentive pay, you offer good benefits, you have to have an idea that this incentive pay and good benefits will translate into superior economic performance that will cover the extra costs of these schemes to the bottom line. Unfortunately, in the case of General Motors, the problem was that the generous benefits offered by the firm to its workers did not translate in higher productivity. And why? Because a large part of these benefits was paid towards pension plans. It wasn't labor income, it was pension income. Look here, they had a 30 and out policy. Workers could retire with a full pension after 30 years of service. You typically start working at an automotive factory upon finishing high school, so you are late teens or early 20s. So when you are at age 50, you could retire with full pension, right? Now, the life expectancy is 70 plus, so for 20 odd years, you paid full pension with health insurance, right? With the increase in life expectancy, what you have is you have nearly five pensioners whose obligations, whose pensions were funded by General Motors. Nearly five retired workers for each active worker as of 2008. So this active worker had to be so super productive as to earn enough money to cover his wage, to cover the pensions of five other guys, and to make some profit for the organization as a whole. No way. No way. Labor costs $73 per hour compared to the $44 per hour at a Toyota factory. Toyota made a huge progress on the US market. Now it's one of the sort of America's favorite cars. And they had Jobs Bank. And the Jobs Bank is even more profligate than this, because whenever you become laid off or redundant, you could receive almost all your wages waiting for reassignment within the organization. So when Toyota entered the market, being super efficient and offering very lean compensation schemes, a lot of workers had to be made redundant because the cars produced by General Motors stopped being competitive. So you had not only five retired workers per poor active worker, but you also had lots of unemployed workers getting 95% of their wages waiting for reassignment. So the pressure, the CNV pressure on each active worker was extremely high, and the firm just imploded under the load of this pressure. It has since reformed completely and things are a lot better. But this is what thoughtless CNV practices can do for you, right? So pension scheme is one of the most important benefits that firms provide, the pension scheme, right? So you can have a company-funded pension scheme, or you can have a pension scheme with employer contribution. Now, the difference is, if it's company-funded pension scheme, as in General Motors, the pension obligations have to be met by the company itself, right? If it's employer-employee contribution-based pension scheme, there is a pension fund, which is an independent legal entity to which you contribute a certain percentage of your labor income, and this contribution is matched by the same contribution from your employer. And this pension fund earns money by investing your pension contributions into financial assets, and on the proceedings from these investments, pensions are paid. And these proceedings can be low or high depending on the economy. But the crucial thing is that unlike in this setting where you would be responsible for agreed level of pension for the rest of the worker's life, under the employer-defined contributions pension scheme, you will be responsible for pension contributions only to a limited extent and only while the worker is employed within your organization. Almost everybody is doing so now, but historically, the first pension schemes were something like this. Procter & Gamble did them in early 20th century, and things have moved a lot since then, because obviously doing it through financial market is more efficient. Now, a third case is a very famous, is a firm made very famous by the work of Edward Lazier. Have you heard of Edward Lazier? It's a father of personnel economics, a very influential academic. He was one of the first people, one of the first researchers to look at the consequences of CNB practices for firm performance, and the very influential paper on performance pay and productivity reports the case of a mid-size US firm called Safelite, not Satellite, Safelite Glass Corporation. It was a mid-size firm that did basically repairs and services on cars, and its sort of key product was windscreens, the windscreens for cars, and workers were installing windscreens. They would get hourly pay in early 90s, they would get an hourly pay of $11 per hour, regardless of how many windscreens they installed. Then the management of Safelite decided, after talking to Lazier, they decided to say, why not pay per windscreen rather than per hour? The idea is very simple, right? If you pay per windscreen, you'll get more windscreens. If you pay per hour, you'll get more hours, not necessarily windscreens. And as a result, the productivity, the labor productivity at Safelite Glass Corporation increased by 44%. 44%! Unbelievable. But this is, you know, one of the early indications that incentives work if you incentivize the sort of activity that you want workers to carry out. You want workers to install lots of windscreens, you pay per windscreen. Well, this logic has its limits. And this idea, if I don't forget it, I will remind you of this idea when we get to performance measurement lecture, performance evaluation lecture. Incentive schemes work in curious ways sometimes. Sometimes these ways are behavioral, right? So people may have an aversion to monetizing the output of their research. So there's a lot of psychology involved in how incentives operate, that's for sure. But it's more important for the purposes of this course to understand that you get what you pay for. You get what you pay for, right? If you're paying per windscreen, as in Lazier's study, you get lots of windscreens. If you pay per rat tail, you get lots of rat tails, as the next case shows. So here's this. Here is a historical account. I took it from a journal called French Colonial History Review, and Michael Vann was documenting this Great Hanoi Rat Massacre as it went down in history. So the French colonial administrators, they settled in Hanoi in Vietnam, and you know, humid weather, lack of infrastructure, basically lots of rats running around. And these people are really, you know, got fed up with having so many rats. They wanted to improve the sanitation facilities of the city, and they want to reduce the number of rats. So they didn't want to have to handle the rats themselves, so they offered a small reward for every rat that the local residents would kill. And of course, to measure their performance, here we come to the issue of performance measurement, to measure their performance, they would require them to provide evidence about exactly how many rats they killed. So the people brought lots of rats to the rat counting desks, and at some point it became unsustainable, hundreds of thousands of rats. And so one person decided to simplify the procedure by only requiring the rat tail to be brought. Well, in a few months' time, they started seeing a lot of rats without tails running on the streets. You get what you pay for, right? If you're paying for rat's tails, you'll get rat's tails. If you want to get better sanitation, you have to pay for a measure of performance that's more closely connected to better sanitation than rat's tails. Figuring this out takes a lot of effort and is not always possible. And in this case, it wasn't really possible because, first of all, there was a performance measurement problem. Second of all, there was what's called perverse incentive problem. And we will look at perverse incentives as well in this course. What was the perverse incentive? Well, some people started farming rats for their tails. So instead of reducing the number of rats, this policy increased the number of rats. Well, then there was a plague epidemic, and officially the death count was 233 people. Of course, not all of them can be attributed to bad incentives, but at least some of them. So bad compensation and benefits practices have consequences not only in the economic domain, but sometimes they can cause rather dramatic consequences to the society at large. So, have you been able to access lectures on Ilias? Have you tried? It's working now? Okay, great. So, now, for the rest of the lecture, let's just look at some basic concepts of compensation and benefits. These are the photographs from the textbook. Sometimes I'll be showing them. Okay, so this is the many forms that pay can take place. These are the many forms that pay can take, right? So you have, of course, cash. This is how much money you get on your bank account. You get benefits. What are the benefits? Not necessarily material benefits. You can have a better office, for instance. You can have an office with a window outside, or you can have an office with a window in the inner court. Is this a benefit? Sure, it's a benefit. At Goethe University, when I faced the choice of having a bigger office with a bad view and smaller office with a good view, I chose the latter, right? So the location and the equipment in your office, they make a difference. They're not going to be monetized. They're part of the benefits. Work-life balance, allowing people to work from home one day a week, is a benefit. Again, it can be monetized. In principle, you can estimate a hedonic wage equation and estimate a premium that people attach to working from home, but firms don't monetize it. If firms want to do it, they do it in a in-kind way rather than monetized way. Now, you have, so the cash and benefits form what's called total compensation. So your compensation and benefits package has two of these components. And in this course, we're going to go through these two components in great detail. But that's not, just for you to know, this is not the end of story. There are also things known in the literature as relational returns. What are the relational returns? It's some strange terms. It's basically, summarily, they describe the non-monetary, non-physical pleasures, non-physical benefits that you get from the work. So, why do you work? You work to secure a certain cash compensation, you work to get these wonderful benefits that you would otherwise have been cut off from, but you also do your work because you like what you're doing. You do your work because you're learning new things. You do your work because you get recognition and status. You know, people in my village, it's a very small conservative German village, they still call me Professor Dr. Zubanov. Forget Nick. Yeah, it's Professor Doctor, right? Feels a bit strange, but it's a sort of recognition. Yeah, and people do their work for recognition. People do their work for employment security. I'm very, you know, happy to be a university professor, not only because I get good cash compensation, but also because I get security of my employment. And being a very risk-averse person, I really appreciate it. Now, this is actually a very active area of research. We're not going to talk a lot more about it, but it's a very active area of research, trying to understand what employment security really is. Is it a benefit? Can employment security be imagined as a benefit? So again, benefit is something that gives you material rewards from your work. Yeah? Can you make can job security be a benefit? You can monetize it, right? There is a you could work, you could be a contract lecturer. You could offer the same amount of teaching services and research services as an independent provider. So you would be self-employed and you would charge a certain market going hourly rate. Not sure I should report how much I earn from my Nebentätigkeiten in this audience, but it's actually, the hourly rate, the implied hourly rate is quite a lot. Or you could have a certain Stelle. You could have a position which is, fixed or permanent. And the implied hourly rate for your work in a fixed position is lower than the rate that you could get from being an independent contractor for the same work. Why? Job security, right? So part of job security can actually be monetized. Income protection sort of thing, right? Your income is protected. But that's not all, because it also gives you a comfortable psychological feeling that you will have the same things to do tomorrow. You will not be left out of the society. You will carry on doing things that you like doing, etc. So there are two dimensions to employment security, one related to benefits and the other one related to what's known as relational return, which is the pleasure and intrinsic the pleasure from and intrinsic motivation to do the work that you do. Now, we're not going to be looking at relational returns, we're going to be looking at compensation and benefits, hence the name of this course. So, speaking about compensation, there are different types of cash compensation. The most interesting, of course, is incentives, because it's a variable compensation which is related to the actual performance that you deliver, not actual performance that you deliver, to a certain measure of your actual performance, which is your actual performance plus some noise term. Yeah? So incentives have different strengths. What do we mean by strength of incentives? It's actually a term that we're going to learn in this course. Think about strength of incentives as the coefficient on the measure of performance that determines your incentives. If this coefficient is large, incentives are very strong. If this coefficient is very small, incentives are weak. So when differences in performance make a big difference to your compensation, then incentives are strong. If they don't make a big difference to your compensation, then incentives are weak. Unusually for a professor, my compensation and benefits package has an incentive component, and the strength of incentives is about 10%. I hope you don't mind me giving lots of examples, and some of these examples are from my compensation and benefits package. Not sure how representative it is of the entire economy, but at least this part of compensation and benefits I know relatively better, so I can give you these examples. Now, benefits, we went through them, more or less. Relational returns, yes. Now, it all feeds into what the textbook calls the pay model. Now, we're not going to be, using this term pay model very often in this course, but what this pay model is an HR view. It's not an economist's view, it's an HR view that summarizes the processes through which compensation and benefits decisions are made and through which they have an effect on organizational performance. So let's have a look. you have objectives that the company, a firm sets before its management, right? A firm has to be efficient, a firm has to be fair, a firm has to comply with relevant legislation, and the behavior of the firm has to be ethical, right? So, and all these items here have some relevance to compensation and benefits. Of course, the bigger, the highest degree of relevance to compensation and benefits is for the efficiency objective. You know, you can become more or less efficient depending on the structure of CNB plans that you will design in your organization. You can be perceived as fair or unfair. Well, these fairness perceptions are, of course, indirect. When you practice a system of very strong incentives, so strong incentives means also very steep career progression and very steep CNB progression, then you may actually be perceived as unfair. If a CEO receives, well, the CEO's wage used to be equal to the wage of 30 workers. So 30 times worker wage was the CEO wage. Nowadays, it's more like 3,000, right? So there's a huge increase in disparities of wages between different levels of organizational hierarchy. And that has implications for how the organization is perceived as being fair or unfair. So this objective, while not directly related to CNB, is still affected by CNB decisions. Compliance, well, obviously. There is a lot of compliance issues involved in the design of compensation and benefit schemes. One example is that by regulation, by law, there must be a cap on CEO compensation in Germany, right? So if you have an incentive scheme, a typical incentive scheme works like this. You have a wage, which is some coefficient beta times performance, right? Now, this scheme will not comply with legislation because legislation says there has to be a cap, right? Now, another example is economic theory shows that an efficient, economically efficient incentive scheme may have a negative pay component. So have you heard of this called residual claimant model? You have a principal and the agent, and if both are risk neutral, the most efficient incentive contract between them is a contract whereby the agent pays the principal a certain fee for using his firm and then appropriates the entire output that the agent earns from the firm. This is very strange. This is how, for instance, taxi drivers sometimes operate. Now, it's not going to comply with most of the labor legislation. There is a minimum wage legislation, which is well above zero. There is a living wage legislation. And all these compliance issues will have an effect on how CNB policies are designed. And of course, there is an ethical element which is connected to fairness, but not identical to fairness. To give you an example of an ethical element of compensation and benefits, life insurance. Life insurance, you know what life insurance is? So life insurance, there is a basic life insurance and there's a, you know, life insurance connected to your pension. But even if you think about basic life insurance, you can take life insurance on your name. And that means that you will be paying a certain amount of money per month. And in the event of your death, your next of kin will receive an agreed amount of money. This is how life insurance works. What we can also do is I can make a life insurance on your name. your name. So I suppose you work for me. I will make life insurance on your name, give you a very inconspicuous piece of paper to sign as part of the many signatures you have to put in your employment contract. You sign it. I will contribute to your life insurance. When you die, it's not your family who will get your life insurance, but it's me who gets your life insurance. Is this compliant with the law? It is. It's legal. It's weird, but it's legal. Is this fair? It's very fair. It's very fair. Look, you haven't paid a penny to your life insurance. I've paid all the money. I financed your life insurance. So why should you get anything from what hasn't been financed by your contribution? It's very fair. Now, is it ethical? No, it's not ethical. I don't know exactly why it's not ethical, but some clever people say it's not ethical. Yeah? So this is practiced by banks. And it's actually very popular practice. Why is it very popular practice? Because the life insurance on the balance, it's actually one of the most liquid assets that banks can have. And now you have this Basel III regulations, which oblige banks to have a certain amount of liquid assets and keep them without investing them in the financial market. Of course, the larger this cap is, the less efficient the bank performance is, but you need to satisfy these Basel regulations, so you need to come up with a sort of assets that you can't that are liquid enough, but you can't use them in financial market. Life insurance is one of such assets. Another asset is goodwill. Objectives, firms have certain objectives, and compensation and benefits policies, have to be in alignment with objectives of the organization. Now, what are the compensation and benefits policies? We've looked at the types of compensation and benefits. What are the policies of compensation and benefits? Well, according to the textbook, there are internal alignment, competitiveness, contributions, and management. So, internal alignment is about paying this roughly the same amount of money for equal contributions that workers make towards the firm. So internal alignment and discrimination are almost complete opposites to each other. So now there are techniques to implement the policies of compensation and benefits, and through these techniques, the CNB policies result into feeding into the objectives that organizations have. So, work analysis, work descriptions, evaluation, and creating internal structure where every job grade is matched with a certain level or certain brackets of wages. This is the result of the policies of internal alignment. How is this policy informed? How are these decisions informed? You do work analysis. You first estimate how productive different people are. Right? How do you do this? You use work descriptions. And then you evaluate employees in certain positions against the work descriptions that correspond to their position. If their activities fulfill the work description, then they are evaluated as capable and they get a wage somewhere in the middle of the bracket. If they exceed them, then they either get promoted or get a wage increase. If they don't exceed them and if they fall below them, then they get demoted or they get a wage decrease. Right? So this way the internal alignment policies work, and they affect which objectives? Well, they affect multiple objectives. They affect the efficiency by influencing performance. They affect fairness perceptions within the organization. They affect, of course, ethics. Whether they affect compliance or not is a very interesting question, because very often you cannot prove that job evaluations and subsequent pay decisions are in compliance or not in compliance with the relevant regulations. So that's a little bit of a gray area. Now, the compensation and benefits policies have to be competitive. What does it mean, competitive? I already mentioned this, you know, you could pay peanuts and get monkey, Or you could pay lots of money and get very good people, right? All these ways, both these ways of offering, both these ways of transacting compensation benefits policies are competitive. What does it mean, competitive, right? Well, competitive means fitting the market, fitting the niche of the market that the organization wants to occupy. If you want to be, if you want to produce the best product in the industry, if your strategy is to be vastly different from the rest of the competition, if your strategy is to be a sort of the best firm there is, right? Then you have to make certain adjustments to your C&B policy, and these adjustments obviously would have to acquire the best people. And that means offering, not only offering high wages, full stop, it also means offering steep, strong incentives. If on the other hand, you want to be a cost leader, if you want to be, if you don't want to be a Rewe of the market, if you want to be an Aldi of the market, there's also a niche for this thing. What does Aldi do? Aldi offers very low wages, right? Relatively low wages. How do you get people to work for these low wages? You have to design their job in the right way. You may want to have to decrease the requirements that employees have to satisfy in order to get a job from your organization. So you may not be the market leader, but you will be the cost cutter. Will your pay policy be competitive? Yes, it will be, because you will take a market niche which you feel, which your business strategy says is currently underpopulated. So what do you do here? You define your market, you survey wages on this market. You don't do it yourself because it's very expensive, but there are lots of small consultancy firms that will do this for you. And if all goes well, I will try to, I can't promise this to you, right? But usually it worked. I have some contacts in the pay consultancy agencies, and they sometimes send people to give guest lectures at universities. This is great fun. They will show you exactly how they do this. It's very interesting. Now they do policy lines, basically what we want to pay and for what services, and that results in the pay structure. Right, so how your pay is linked not only internally, but also how it's linked to the rest of the market. Now, does this affect the objectives of the organization? Yes, it does. It affects quality, it affects customer satisfaction, it affects, at the end of the day, efficiency and performance. These guys are relatively unaffected here. So, contributions. So contribution is basically how it's a strange word, but what it means is, it means how pay is reflects the effort and other contributions that employee make to the organization. So you could design your contributions policy on the basis of merit-based pay. So the longer you work, the more money you get. There is an economic rationale for this, but if you don't want to be General Motors, you shouldn't do merit pay. There is incentives, right? So if you want to be a Safelite Glass Corporation and have a 44% increase in productivity, you should do incentive pay. Just make sure you don't pay too much, because Safelite actually went bankrupt a few years after. Now, merit guidelines, pay for performance, so basically all these contributions, policies under the heading contribution will result in the actual constellation of pay practices under the heading pay for performance, which obviously affects organizational goals. And then there is a management of compensation and benefits. So not only are there HR people and C&B consultants that survey the market, photograph the working day, and decide on the strength of incentives and procedures to evaluate performance to offer incentives, there's also a management of the compensation and benefits scheme, which looks at, which makes sure that the costs of compensation and benefits scheme do not exceed their budgets, and the policies related to compensation benefits are clearly communicated to the employees. So this is a rather sort of managerial administrative function of CNB, not a strategic one, and therefore will be given relatively less attention in this course. Now, these are the sort of illustration, the explanations of CNB objectives. This is an illustration of the notion of internal alignment that we've already gone through. External competitiveness, that's basically it. That's basically everything I wanted to talk in this lecture. So let's just do a little summary. I've spoken about the course organization. I think it's clear. If you still have any questions about course organizations, please contact me, preferably in person. Just knock on my door. If you insist on sending emails, you can do that as well. But for most of the lecture, we were talking about CNB and its importance for firm performance. The importance of CNB for firm performance is huge. So anyone interested in management, I think, should take a course in compensation benefits. So you've come to the right place. CNB matters for firm performance because mainly because it affects workers' effort, but also it matters for firm performance because it affects the firm's bottom line. Then we looked at the processes. We had a sort of bird's eye view of the processes of compensation and benefits management from the point of view of the link between companies' objectives and CNB policies. Of course, for the rest of the course, we will be looking at the techniques and processes through which CNB policies are implemented. It's just a bird's eye view. And we have, let's summarize this discussion by saying that later on we'll learn a lot more about, you know, the design of these processes. Now, what you're not going to learn, this is the last thing I have to say in this introduction. What you're not going to learn is the technical and administrative details of how compensation and benefits policies are implemented. You're not going to learn it for, well, a few reasons. The most important reason is that I myself have no experience in the technical aspects of implementation of compensation and benefits. I have a little bit of experience, and I will tell you about it when we get to tutorials. I was involved in the implementation of a bonus scheme once, but I don't have a day-to-day experience in working with these things. So it's not ethical to teach something that you don't know. The second reason, and more important, this reason is that the compensation and benefits practices vary a lot between firms. So no point teaching you a certain practice of compensation and benefits today, whereas when you get to the labor market and are employed by the firms, and these firms will ask you to do compensation and benefits. So you see it's all and. The practices of compensation and benefits and the ways they are implemented in that particular firm may be quite different from what you've learned, which is quite possible, right? Rather, this course will equip you with the, if you like, an insight into the logic of CNB decisions that you may have a chance to successfully apply in your professional careers. So, I hope I have interested you enough to take this course. You can still drop out if you like, but I hope not many will. And I look forward to meeting you next week. Thank you.